University of Western Ontario.
Well, I want to thank Steve and the organizers of the meeting for inviting, allowing me to talk. It's a set of issues I've been concerned about. The title is a bit grandiose. It should be something more just like implications of uniqueness of the universe and my worries about a common argument that's given. It addresses more one particular argument related to cosmological laws than trying to give a survey of the topic. But thanks for the invitation to speak. This is exactly the kind of audience where I hope to get a lot of constructive feedback on this work. So there's an argument that you can find all over the place. Here's an instance of it from Wolfgang Pauli, which says, the natural scientist is concerned with a particular kind of phenomena. He has to confine himself to that which is reproducible. I do not claim that the reproducible is more important than the unique, but I do claim that the unique exceeds treatment by the scientific method. Indeed, it is the aim of this method to find and to test natural laws. So I think there's something both intuitively right about this argument, and there's something I find deeply problematic about the argument. The very quick move from saying something unique to saying that it's inaccessible to the scientific method, there are problematic implications of that for any kind of historical science where you're trying to explain a unique event. What does this sort of argument imply for those subjects? And in particular, what does it imply for the science of cosmology? So although I sort of think there's interesting points here, I think the overall aim of the talk today is to deconstruct this sort of uniqueness argument, try to spell it out in more detail, and then assess what element of truth there is to it and what we should say about it. Now I have a second quote here to just give an indication of, throughout cosmology there's often been claims that there's a unique method or aim that's appropriate to cosmology. And there have been different characterizations of what this unique method should be at different times. Here's a quote from Dinesh Sharma. We must find some way of eliminating the need for an initial condition to be specified. Only then will the universe be subject to the role of theory. This provides us with a criterion so compelling that the theory of the universe which best is almost certain to be right. Now, I put this quote up partly because Sharma was talking about the steady state theory. This was in 1959, and of course, soon after, he acknowledged that there was one more compelling criteria, namely empirical adequacy. So this was meant to be an argument in favor of the steady state theory, given that it eliminated the need to postulate initial conditions. And yet, of course, Sharma acknowledged a few years later, actually before the discovery of the background radiation, that the steady state theory was not compatible with observational evidence. So this is just an indication of the kind of argument that you see in cosmology that I think is something that's interesting, but we need to reflect further on. So the things I'm going to focus on are different senses of epistemic limits in cosmology, or limits to what cosmology can do. One, I think, is more clear-cut, which is the question of what the finite speed of light implies for limitations to cosmology. So I'm going to talk about the limits on observationally establishing global properties of the universe. Then there's the other claim that because the universe is unique, there's something importantly limiting about that uniqueness, which is what I'm going to dwell on in more detail. And the question is then, given a characterization of these limits, what does this imply for the appropriate aims and methods of cosmology, with the cautionary worry of the Sharma quote to remind us that, we have to be worried about imposing a priori principles on cosmology. Yeah.
Can you define the universe for us?
We
could be here a long time.
Sorry?
We could be here a long time.
There have been a lot of debates. Are you worried about, in particular, whether I call the multiverse a universe or?
Observable universe. We've got the observed universe, and
we right.
have a full universe, and
right.
we have, possible other disconnected universes, and so on.
Right. So at this stage, I think the I'm trying to think of where it will matter in my argument, what stand I take on this. At this stage, I think I'll just say what I'm interested in at the moment is the uniqueness of the observable universe. And I don't have to take a stand on whether...
Right.
So, and maybe at different points in the argument, I might have to worry about what I... exactly whether that definition will hold later on. So just as an outline then, I'll talk first about limits on observability, and then talk about limits, implications of uniqueness, and then pose more for discussion questions about laws and initial conditions and cosmology based on the foregoing. So this is probably unnecessary for this audience, but when did we start talking about global solutions or global cosmological models? Well, it was, to use a very memorable phrase from Roberto Toretti, Einstein's lunge for totality in 1917, where he first introduced the idea of a global solution of the field equations. And this was in response not to any sort of empirical pressures or any particular problem in astronomy. It was rather Einstein's attempt to see if Mach's principle could be guaranteed to hold in general relativity. And he had gotten worried about this after his completion of the field equations and this mad race with Hilbert in November of 1915. He put the capstone on this incredible month in his life, finished the field equations, and then entered into correspondence with Willem de Sitter, where he started to worry that one of the guiding ideas that he said led him to the field equations wasn't in fact guaranteed to hold. Namely, this is one way he formulated Mach's principle during this time. There can be no inertia relative to space, but only inertia of masses relative to one another. The worry was that the solution that he knew at the time, the Schwarzschild solution, seemed to require a stipulation about boundary conditions at infinity. That seemed to be something that meant there was an inertia of masses relative to this boundary condition. This was a vestige of absolute space. It seemed that Mach's principle then didn't hold in his cosmological theory. So in order to get rid of boundary conditions, he then decides to look for a solution in which you have no boundaries. Therefore, no boundary conditions, and this is the Einstein static solution. And in doing this, in leaping to describing the full universe, he effectively changed the nature of cosmology. And subsequently, there is a large part of cosmology that's devoted to the study of solutions of the Einstein field equations, which can be treated as global models. They have well-defined global properties. And then in that sense, we're now talking about global properties of space-time. So, but of course, our observations in relativity are limited because of the finite speed of light. So we have only observational access to light coming to us from our past light cone. This is a diagram borrowed from George Ellis. This is our light cone. This is also, I'm sure, familiar. We'll have some information from close to our past world line in terms of records of physical systems that are in our neighborhood. And then we'll also have light reaching us from on our past light cone. But you can consider a set of ideal observations that might be available to you if you imagine these extremely wonderful situations that astronomers would love to be in, where you have a collection of standard candles, you know how they evolve, you imagine that they're distributed throughout the universe. What could you establish if you had ideal observational data of that sort? Well, George Ellis has argued that that kind of data will be sufficient to fix the geometry on the null cone itself. And you actually have to assume the dynamics. You have to assume the Einstein field equations to do this. And any extension beyond this null cone requires a no interference condition, some condition about the conditions outside the past light cone in order to make an inference to the future of that point. Right? So observations in relativity are limited in this way. Now, what does that lead to regarding global properties of the space-time models? Here, there's an idea that was introduced in the philosophical literature by Gleamore and Malamut. If you're interested in whether we could observationally establish whether a certain global property of a manifold or of a cosmological model holds, you're asking the question of whether that property will vary between observationally indistinguishable counterparts. Now, the idea is that you imagine one space-time manifold in which you have points and you look at their past light cones. Turns out to be easier to use the chronological paths, the I minus P sets, which are the interior of these cones. But in effect, what you require for M prime to be an observationally indistinguishable counterpart of M, you require that for every point P, there's a point P prime such that the past light cone of this point in M is isometrically embedded into this other manifold M prime. And the idea is then, of course, that given that even an ideal observer will only be able to establish the space-time within this past light cone, they would actually be unable to determine whether they were in the manifold M or M prime. It's called the clothesline construction because you basically can imagine hanging these pieces of space-time on a clothesline, and then you can put arbitrary filler in between them such that this still satisfies the relatively weak requirements that something needs to satisfy just to be a space-time. Now, of course, it's going to be a crazy-looking space-time, but from the point of considering what's accessible to a given observer, you have the claim that for any observer in M, idealized now as occupying a point in the space-time, there will be a corresponding point that looks exactly the same in terms of all the metrical properties of the other of the original space-time. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question for David. What's it really matter that this is done in two space-times? Because you're constructing a thing that has this crazy causal structure, right? There are massive violations of causal faithfulness condition. And
what's the causal faithfulness condition?
That that there's some kind of a causal explanation of perfect correlations, right? Because you're going to be if I nest the cones on the left, then there's going to have to be a cone like that on the hanging from the clothesline. So you're going to have perfect correlations between separated components of space that reflect what would have happened in space time one had time been allowed to run. But the basic point is, I mean, epistemically, why not just say there's a collection of space times and whatever happens in this one happens in one of those. I mean, and then you can have plausible space times on the right. Why is it any better to have just a single space time, which is the skeptical alternative, that's a crazy looking one, as opposed to a collection of natural looking ones that might have been, for everything you've seen up till now, the right one?
Right, that's an interesting question. I don't understand, so I'm not sure.
It seems to me to be irrelevant here.
The fact that all of the points are isometrically embedded in one other space-time.
Yeah, because it's still a problem of induction if there are a bunch of different ones that are because they're plausible, right? They'd be plausible candidates instead of crazy ones that nobody takes seriously.
Right, well, so first of all, I think I'd question what grounds you'd have for saying that you shouldn't. So it's a very restricted game, right? You say what you're restricted to is just deductively what you can establish based on observations of your past light cone. So the point is, when you invoke global reasons for saying that this one's crazy, you're saying something beyond what you could deductively establish from observations of your past light cone. And I'll grant that, and I'll say, look, we might have inductive principles that would allow you to break this standoff. But
I'm saying the skepticism is just as serious or more so if it's not all crammed into one alternative statement.
Right, and so I think that'd be a way of redefining this, and I think you'd get the same result, which is that very few global properties are going to be shared between these two, because the ability to isometrically embed essentially one open set corresponding to the causal paths of a point doesn't constrain the global structure of the space-time. Lee, sorry, you've had your hand.
So I'm behind. So can I just query the
yeah.
argument? The argument is, for their claim is that there are two distinct space-times, M and mm-hmm. M prime, such that for every event in M, mm-hmm. there exists an event in M prime such that the causal past of P is isometric to P prime.
Yes.
Okay. And the claim is that basically I just have a bunch of disjoint causal paths, and they can be whatever they are. Is that
right. You could. So the point is that you start off saying we're not going to put global constraints on M prime.
Putting global constraints. If two points P1 and P2 have a certain causal relation in mm-hmm. M, does their image have that same causal relation in M prime?
Well, let's say you had P and let's say you have Q here. Then there'll be a copy Q prime.
Okay, so Q prime is not necessarily.
It's not necessarily. Yeah, exactly.
So
that's what Kevin was first saying.
Yeah. So why don't you just add the condition that you preserve and dismount the causal relations among the points? And then
right, and you can.
Then I think there's a theorem that forgets physical space times with symmetries. That for generic space times with no symmetries. The metric, the space-time Montefiore morphisms is determined by the causal relations, etc., so that this ambiguity goes away.
So this is Malamud's theorem, right? Or I think he actually proved something like this in 78. I think what you have to say is something like, given the causal structure in the space of what continuous
and volume elements.
Yeah, and volume elements. Then
then you determine a metric up to Diffie morphisms. Which is a space-time.
Right. So the question is, why would you think that the epistemic situation of a single observer is captured better, or our observational situation is captured better by a curve going all the way to infinite affine length than a point? So the reason for formulating the definition this way, and actually Gleemore formulated it originally in terms of curves, and Malamud gave a formulation in terms of points, partly because it seems that, our observational situation isn't that we have an infinite curve of the future and all of the data collected along that. It's actually more appropriate to idealize it as a single point in the space-time manifold. And then, I think the...
The point is sort of... George Ellis's point that given our past observations, mm-hmm. there could be many space-times which differ by data outside of our past
income. Right, with very different global properties.
So if you're trying to make that point is true.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what does this add to that? This is what I'm not getting. This seems like a really baroque construction.
Well,
directed toward a metaphysical point rather than an epistemic point, which is where I thought you were.
I wasn't going for a metaphysical point. I mean, this is... Maybe it's baroque. I thought it was a clear way of making this point, which is just that you can then ask, given this definition, which global properties will be the same in the two spacetimes, and it turns out essentially none. I mean, the existence of a Cauchy surface, all these other things, which are global properties of the spacetime manifold, are not the same in these two counterparts, and that gives you a very clear way of making the Ellis point.
It is observable. I mean, Jana can speak to that. There certainly are observables in our past light cone that are measurable if the universe is closed and our past
right.
light cone.
Right. If it's closed within our past within our horizon volume, yeah. Certainly. Yeah, I didn't mean to say that
was. Questions about the global topology of the universe are observable if we're lucky. But not
right. Yeah. So that's yeah. So what I claimed is that there are certain global properties that will vary. I didn't say having compact spatial topology is one of those properties, right? So if you had, identifications within a compact, the sorts of things that you've worked on, I mean, that would be something that you'd see in all of these past light cones, so it would show up in the counterpart as well, so that wouldn't be a property that is underdetermined in this sense. So, yeah, so I didn't mean to say that, you know, global topology is underdetermined. It's rather specific types of features, such as the existence of a Cauchy surface, can't be established from the viewpoint of a single single point in space-time. So perhaps this was more Baroque than necessary, but I thought it would be a way of a cleanly stating if you have this very restrictive notion of what we can do deductively from observations, we can't actually establish much from our observations of the past light cone about the global properties of the space-time manifold. And I should say that it's a little quick. There are, for example, if you have failures of certain global causal structure of the manifold. So, for example, if you had a causal pathology like a closed-time light curve, well, that will show up in the past light cone of some observer here. So that will be preserved. It's rather the features that are global that won't be in common between those. And recently, one of Malamud's students, John Manchak, actually proved what Malamud had conjectured, that this closed line construction will work, except in cases where you have this unusual kind of pathology. Okay, so what are the ramifications of this with regard to what we claim about what we can claim about the global structure of space-time? Well, I think my response is kind of a deflationary response, that, well, any kind of local to global inference that we would want to make will require further global assumptions. So if you're willing to accept something like a cosmological principle, a principle regarding the typicality of observers, or other principles of that form, those are explicitly global principles about the structure of space-time, that would underwrite a kind of inference from local observed properties on the past light cone to claims about the global structure of the space-time. And I also think that this isn't such a threatening form of underdetermination in the following sense. We're not talking about theoretical underdetermination in the way that it often gets discussed, because we're talking about models within general relativity. We've sort of got a common theoretical framework that we're using that we're not actually going outside of. What's underdetermined is just the structure of the space-time outside your light cone. That isn't so surprising. It isn't like the stronger kind of underdetermination worries about whether general relativity is a correct theory describing the cosmological situation or anything of that nature. It's rather a much more limited kind of underdetermination. And so in that sense, and a final point is that I don't actually think it's my response is deflationary in the sense that I don't think much rides on exactly what claims you make about the global properties of space-time, given that those aren't the sort of things that are actually important in the practice of cosmology. They're not the sort of things that we actually are concerned to try to establish. So even if you just read any claim about the global features of space-time as a kind of conditional claim, I don't think you're going to lose much in terms of the scientific practice. So in other words, if you say, well, we want to speculate about the fate of the universe, that might depend on exactly what global features it has. Any claim of that sort will have to be a conditional claim, namely, if we are typical, then we can make claims about the global properties of the universe. Or, you know, if we accept some version of this ampliative principle, then we can make these larger claims. Now, I think there's a more interesting set of questions here, which, given that this is a quote from Lee, maybe he can elaborate on. But there's a worry here from a more, I guess, operationalist point of view, that if we have global properties in our theory that are inaccessible in this sense, that might lead us to reconsider the theory and perhaps push us towards a reformulation of the theory. So this is from a 2000 paper. Every quantity in a cosmological theory that is formally an observable should in fact be measurable by some observer inside the universe. Part of what I've been saying is just that the kinds of quantities I was talking about clearly aren't measurable by some observer inside the universe. And so you might try to reformulate a theory in such a way that you don't have those featuring as observables. Now, there are a lot of other issues involved here, in particular the question of what's observable in a diffeomorphism invariant theory that I think are maybe closer to the core of the issues that Smolin is discussing. But this is at least a worry that there might be some sort of mathematical surplus here in describing global properties. Now, let me shift gears now and look at the implications of uniqueness, the second argument. This is a quote from Milton Munitz, a philosopher, who lays out the argument that we saw earlier from Pauli. With respect to these familiar laws of physics, we should also mark it as a prerequisite of the very meaning and use of such laws that we be able to refer to an actual, or at least possible, plurality of instances to which the law applies. For unless there were a plurality of instances, there would be neither interest nor sense in speaking of a law at all. If we knew that there were only one actual or possible instance of some phenomena, it would hardly make sense to speak of finding a law for this unique occurrence, qua unique. This last situation is, however, precisely what we encounter in cosmology. For the fact that there is at least but not more than one universe to be investigated makes the search for laws in cosmology inappropriate. So here we have a quite explicit argument from the claim that, given that the universe is unique, to a claim about what the appropriate aim of cosmology is. Namely, it shouldn't aim at searching for laws. Here's a similar kind of argument that... Sorry?
Can I just make one quick remark?
Sure.
Depends what you mean by laws, right? Because Hubble's law is a cosmological law. It makes perfect sense.
Right.
So you must be talking about initial conditions, laws of initial conditions?
Right. No, I'm going to get to that in just a moment. There's an ambiguity that's exactly what you've identified between whether you think of cosmological laws, just physical laws extrapolated to apply to the universe as a whole, or laws of initial conditions or something of that sort. So I think Munitz elsewhere draws that distinction, so he's aware of that. And I think he's talking about laws of the universe, namely laws of initial conditions in that argument, although he's actually not as clear as he should be in the passage, given that he's drawn the distinction elsewhere in the same paper. So...
Certainly, Bondi made very much the same point in his 1956
yes.
book, or 1952?
1952,
earlier,
I think.
Mm-hmm. And John Leslie, I think it's in Canada, more recently John Leslie mm-hmm. has made the comment that it would be a strange sort of law that would operate only once.
Right. No, so I didn't mean to say that Munitz was the only person to make that claim. And because of the steady state theory, Munitz was writing at a time when philosophers had sort of entered into these debates with the steady-state theory, mainly because the steady-state theorists had said things like what Sharma had said, that there's a sort of constraint on methodology that was appropriate in cosmology. And so then the philosophers of science started to get involved in this debate. And so Munitz is quite explicitly responding to Bondi and others.
Right.
So,
can I make this one? I'm always skeptical about you can't have laws of a unique thing. Let's just...
I am as well.
I thought you were... Let's just take the solar system and imagine that it was covered with clouds so we couldn't see outside. It would be perfectly possible, and Ptolemy did this, to work out pretty good laws of that solar system. And there are many instantiations of the same system because of the evolution of time.
Mm-hmm.
And those are many different instantiations, and different observers coming in at different epochs will, given those different instantiations of the initial data, will construct the whole thing out on a class. And so I just don't see this problem. I think Bondi and...
Right, so I'm in agreement with you. Yeah. I have maybe a slightly different way of spelling out my disagreement, but I'm largely in agreement that there's something
Great.
Fishy about this argument. So.
Can I just throw in another
yeah.
one? Because there are two things here conflating. One is the law of initial conditions,
mm-hmm.
because that's sort of over and done. If there's bang, that's
mm-hmm.
it. And the other is whether we could imagine there being a cosmological law, which Julian was just saying, which is meaningful because it's extending over time.
Right.
And I remember when I first read Bondi's book, because I was interested in cosmology as an undergraduate, and I read this book, and I thought, well, how can you write down anything for the universe as a whole? And I thought, oh, he's just applying general relativity to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that all? And I remember thinking, but aren't there laws of the universe which would
you know, not so heavy, as you said, extrapolations of local physics to the universe as a whole. We can't rule out that there might be such laws.
Right, so...
there would maybe a conflict, of course, with local physics, or maybe, you know, consistent with it all.
Right, no, I agree that that distinction is crucial, and that maybe... So this is a similar formulation of the argument that we saw from Munitz. This is from a recent article by Ellis. I put this here because he emphasizes a common kind of set of methodological claims that get mentioned in these sorts of arguments, namely you can't experiment with the universe. We can't, well, as far as we know, create universes in the laboratory. And also... you don't have an ensemble of universes that you can observationally access. So it's not like, situations in astronomy where you can have numerous instances of objects of the same kind, which you can then do a sample of. And from these two points, he draws a very similar conclusion to what Munitz claimed on the previous slide, with the same ambiguity about what you mean exactly by laws of physics. And I think that's my next slide. I think the argument here, you have to say something about how you understand laws of nature and also something about scientific method in order to validate this claim that A3 is directly a consequence of A1 and A2. And this is all quoting from Ellis. I come back to the two sorts of laws in a moment. But let me just look at a few different responses to this kind of argument. One response is to say, okay, cosmology is inherently limited in a way. It's not a law-seeking science. Instead, it's a historical science that would make it distinctive compared to other parts of physics. We might try to evade the conclusion in different ways. I think you can see the steady-state theorists is doing this. They accept a methodology in which the argument doesn't go through. I'm not going to discuss that in more detail. I'm not exactly sure what to say about the multiverse approaches. They seem to deny the second claim, namely that you don't have an ensemble of universes. But, of course, they're still not observationally accessible, so it's not exactly clear how to characterize their position.
But also because you have a unique multiverse.
Right.
That itself has got laws or meta-laws.
Right.
So you're just shifting the problem up a bit.
Yeah, so maybe you're not really evading the conclusion, but accepting it and just re-describing the laws of our patch then as a different level. Now, what I want to suggest is that we should really just look at more carefully at what the assumptions are about laws and method that we need to complete the argument. And here I finally get to the point that everybody else has already made. There are two senses of cosmological laws we might be talking about. One is just local laws extrapolated to the universe as a whole, such as the field equation to general relativity. And obviously, there's a sense in which there isn't a problem of how many, you know, is there just a single instance of those? Well, they're instantiated in every subregion. If you treat each subregion as an independent model, it will also satisfy the field equations, right? So in that sense, there are multiple instantiations of cosmological laws in this first sense. And there's a second sense, which I would take to be perhaps two different cases. One, laws explicitly formulated in terms of global properties. And secondly, laws governing the creation event itself. Now, these would be laws of the universe in a sense that isn't just an extrapolation from subsystems of the universe to the whole thing. Now, these, I think, are subject to some worries. They lack multiple instantiations. And the question... perhaps I'll just pose this as a question for discussion. It's actually hard to come up with cases of cosmological laws in the second sense. And maybe we can discuss whether they're actually central to what, you know, in which research programs these cases of laws come up, what are some examples of them, and so on. But I think most of the laws we think of as applying in cosmology are actually of the first sort. They're local laws that are then extrapolated to govern the universe as a whole. Now, the worry I have, I'll start off by just criticizing one way that philosophers have often thought of laws as being related to phenomena. So this is the sort of thing you get in an intro philosophy of science course where you say, well, a law has this form for all x, fx then gx, and then you think that, so all swans are white is an example of this. If it's a swan, then it's white. And then you think of confirmation by instances, where it's just logical instantiation. The first claim is just there's a swan, it's white, and so on. Now, I think seeing laws in relation to phenomena as something like instantiation in this sense is a horrible mistake. There's more to be said here, but briefly, if you take this approach to describing laws, you have to take the laws as formulated in the same language as the evidence claims that you're considering. And so the laws then seem to have direct empirical content in the same way as the evidence claims. They're just more general statements. And in particular, if we look at cases in physics, I think this really collapses a distinction between laws and equations of motion in terms of how they relate to phenomena. So let me elaborate on that point just a bit by considering, I think, one of the bad consequences of this kind of mistake. So there's a position, this is a quote from Nancy Cartwright's book, How the Laws of Physics Lie. And I think this is a kind of consequence of collapsing this distinction between laws and equations of motion in terms of how to understand their content. So she says, for bodies which are both massive and charged, the law of universal gravitation and Coulomb's law interact to determine the final force. But neither law by itself truly describes how the bodies behave. No charged objects will behave just as the law of universal gravitation says, and any massive objects will constitute a counterexample to Coulomb's law. These two laws are not true. Worse, they are not even approximately true. In the interaction between the electrons and the protons of an atom, for example, the Coulomb effect swamps the gravitational one, and the force that actually occurs is very different from that described by the law of gravity. So the claim here is that the laws of physics lie in the sense that they're directly contradicted in these sorts of situations. Now, how does Cartwright respond to this issue? She says, well, what we should think of as laws have these embedded ceteris paribus clauses. So ceteris paribus is just a Latin phrase that means other things being equal. And so the rough form of the clause is going to be something like the following. If there are no forces other than gravity, then the force exerted by two bodies on each other obeys the gravitational force law. Now, John Roberts has written a paper in reply, as has Sheldon Smith. And the move that I think I want to highlight for my purposes is the response to this emphasizes that the laws are more abstract than the sort of instantiation picture allows, right? So laws themselves are not falsified. Instead, we have cases of the phenomena, in the case described on the previous slide, compared to equations of motion derived from the law with different situations, right? So in one case, you're neglecting Coulomb's force. In the other case, you're neglecting the gravitational force. What you have is, if anything, a contradiction between a set of derived equations of motion and a set of phenomena. It's not clear why you'd say the laws lie in those situations. And the more general point is that there's, in the comparison between the phenomena and the, the more general point is that there's a sort of recipe that the laws are a part of, which allows you to generate claims that are then compared to phenomena. So the laws themselves are more abstract in a sense. They don't have the kind of content that Cartwright is tempted to attribute to them. Namely, the laws themselves don't directly imply that there's going to be a temporal sequence of a particular sort. Rather, they say, given the laws and some other conditions, you can derive an equation of motion which describes that sort of behavior. Steve, you had a...
Yeah, I just wasn't clear what the distinction was between laws and equations of motion. So the equations of motion you have in mind is some sort of particular equation for the that describes the trajectory of a particle that's being under the influence of gravitation and electromagnetism?
Well, it doesn't... So...
just thinking, because I think Maxwell's equations, those are laws, and two of them are... equations of motion, so they seem to be So I feel like I'm missing the point because I run them right together there. I think most laws take the form of equations of motion.
Well, what I'm saying is that there's differential equations that you derive from. So let's take the case that Cartwright's talking about. So you'd have Newton's laws as well as some assumption about what forces are relevant. So, for example, let's just say that the gravitational force is relevant, and we neglect Coulomb's force. And then we derive a differential equation, which we can then use to describe the evolution over time of a body's motion. Right? That's what I'm calling the equation of motion, that last bit. Maybe you should just call it the differential equation derived from the laws supplemented by these other features. Yeah. So maybe my terminology is...
No. I think other people are being misled here because normally one would expect the Einstein field equation to be incomplete. And normally you would want a story about what generates stress energy tensor. And normally, say in a classical context, you would want to couple it to theories of elasticity or theories of a fluid and so on. Now it so happens that sort of there are simplifications that people make to get a crude estimate of the universe to use like a dust model, where you are bypassing the need for those other equations that you would normally need to get a well set group of equations that would be an evolutionary structure. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's just like F equals ma. If you don't have any forces turned on, so that's your equation of motion. It's kind of trivial. But as soon as you got forces, then you've got to have laws to govern those forces, and the package has to be assembled.
Right.
And F equals ma doesn't tell you enough, just part.
Yeah, so the...
Right, I just want to say it's a, F equals ma is an equation of motion. It's a differential equation.
I think you mean something like a well set evolutionary well set evolutionary operator or something like that.
Yeah, that's thanks.
I'm not sure. Okay.
So again, the point for my purposes is to really emphasize that seeing the phenomena is just an instantiation of the laws in any sort of direct logical way is a mistake, and that you have to have more subtlety in describing how the laws relate to the phenomena. And in response to the argument that Munitz and others have given, my move is to say, well, when you recognize this, then it actually allows you to say something more about how you could actually test laws for a unique system. And so we can test laws via implications for phenomena obtained across distinct systems, and this is the emphasis on experimental reproducibility. We can certainly test laws in that way, but it's not clear why we can't also think of testing laws in terms of giving a more detailed description of a single system. So why does the uniqueness of the system itself rule out the possibility of testing laws via, in some sense, the internal constraints they impose on the system? And again, that's because, so the move contra Cartwright is meant to open up some space here for understanding the relation between the laws and the system to be more interesting than just somehow instantiating the laws. And so once you have that space, it seems like it's clear that there's a sense in which you could test laws for a single system. So we could approach complicated systems. I mean, we typically do approach complicated systems via successive approximations. And the laws are in effect tested not by their counterfactual implications or their implications for other systems, but rather via their role in deriving this series of increasingly detailed equations to describe the system at hand. And so testability in this sense depends not on the existence of other systems, but on the possibility of discovering further details regarding the system at hand. So this gives us a way of thinking about how you could test laws on a unique system that evades the arguments.
This is beautifully illustrated in the history of Newtonian dynamics. The perturbation theory.
Exactly. No, I mean, that's
beautiful.
In the back of my mind, I'm typically thinking of the solar system here and the description, the more and more detailed description of the solar system that you have within Newtonian dynamics. I mean, that's exactly the kind of case I have in mind. So that's my last slide, I think, in terms of replies to this argument regarding the uniqueness of the universe. So, so now the question that I want to, a series of discussion questions that I then want to close with, I don't have slides for this, but the question then is, so this is one argument relating to laws in cosmology that would give cosmology a kind of special status. Now, I don't think that sort of replying to this argument means that there's nothing interesting then about laws and initial conditions in cosmology, but I think we have to then say something more than just the universe is unique and therefore we can't seek cosmological laws. And one thing I'm curious about is what other people's views are about what's interesting about cosmology in this respect. Is it something that is there a feature of cosmology such as the fact that in order to describe the early universe, we have to rely on more and more speculative theories as we go back, just given the perhaps contingent features of our universe that the universe started in initial singularity and then it's at perhaps arbitrarily high energies. Is that the feature of our universe that makes certain parts of cosmology so difficult, not the uniqueness of the object of study itself? Or are there other features of the universe? So, for example, this sort of picture only makes sense if you can imagine discovering further details regarding the system in a way that allows you to successively test the laws you've introduced. Is it going to be difficult in cosmology to carry out this series of successive approximations just because of the data that's available to us? So there's two ways in which the features of cosmology that make the laws and initial condition contrast so troubling might be related to aspects of cosmology other than the uniqueness of the universe. And so I guess I'll close with that and then open it up for discussion.
So you want to ask the first question? Sorry, there was a clue behind this. Oh, not anything like drum. So I'm wondering, your instinct is to go to the structure, the physics, to answer this. And I'm wondering if maybe we shouldn't step back first and look at methodology as motivation. Why are these guys so concerned about repeatability? It sounds like they have some kind of presupposition about how induction works, right, as opposed to what the structure of physics is. And what could that be? I mean, if you're a Bayesian, you know, you don't feel a speed bump about repeatability or observability or anything else. It's just all a matter of how your conditional probabilities fit together, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't care about repeatability. I mean, the business that there's a presupposition of testability in terms of repeatability wouldn't be on the radar for you, right? So there's a whole group of people who don't even think this is an issue. What they might say is, well, if you care about such things, and many of them don't, that unless you could gather more information about this, then maybe you might not converge to the right answer because, in light of your early result, you know, you might be stuck to the information you can gather on a single world line forever. And if the light comes taper, like in Clark's construction, there might be something off over here that you've never seen, right? Mm-hmm. That might be an issue about convergence, but a lot of Bayesians would say, the heck with that, you know, we live in the present. So we don't care about convergence. It's just that we've seen this universe, we have these priors, and we've got this huge confirmation for this cosmological theory. End of story. And then if you ask them, what about the successive approximation, they say, well, that's just getting coherent, right? We don't even have a clear algebra of propositions on the table. So this is a stopgap thing for actually constructing our Bayesian model on the fly as we go, right? So I think that's a very different picture from the one you presented.
It is. As far as I'm aware, none of the people who've made this kind of uniqueness argument are Bayesians. So I think you're right that there's an interesting question about what kind of methodology are they presuming. And so, you know, there's usually an implied contrast, like here's what we do in the rest of physics and cosmology is different, right? Now, I don't know I'm pretty sure that none of the places I've seen this argument made is the implied contrast, well, we're Bayesians, and then there's this weird stuff about cosmology. And you're probably right that it's interesting to ask, well, what is their presumed methodology in the rest of physics? And part of what I was arguing is that the assumptions about method actually don't seem that plausible, given the trying to fill in the account of laws needed to make their arguments good in terms of the contrast they draw with cosmology. I don't think they actually have a very plausible account of method. And I think, I mean, you're sort of indicating a broader project, namely, within a given account of method, how do these debates play out? And I think that's a good project, but I don't have that much to report on.
So it's a nice, I feel like, I mean, it's a nice point you're making, but it's not good enough.
And okay.
Here's why you think this really is an issue. Because it really is an issue in some real life problems in theoretical and experimental cosmology, which confront us now. So let me mention.
Okay.
Okay. So there is inflation, and there are predictions that the fluctuations in the CMB are Gaussian. Which means statistically uncorrelated. Okay, sometime a year and a half ago, an observation was made in the data that there is non-Gaussian. It doesn't really matter for my student, but you know what that is. But it was a deviation from the prediction of the known inflation. Within days, there were two kinds of papers, and by now there are many, many versions of each offered to explain this observation, which in the meantime probably has gone away, but again, that's not relevant. One of them was a change in the loss, that is the potential by which the inflaton field evolves, and the other is modification of the initial conditions. At issue is that there's a huge degeneracy. And it is not true that more detailed examination can resolve the degeneracy, that is any move that you can make changing the laws to accommodate the data to come on this could be mirrored by a move that could be made to change the initial conditions.
Just to clarify, were the initial conditions, by that do you mean the sort of pre-inflationary conditions or the parameters of the inflaton field itself?
So again, if this was a laboratory system, we could easily do experiments where we're in control of the initial condition. We could distinguish the effect of hypotheses of changing the law from hypotheses of changing the initial conditions. Here we cannot. And I think the claim that we want to make and other people who worry about this want to make is that as long as you're dealing with a kind of law that allows a distinction between the laws and the initial conditions, you're in trouble in cosmology ultimately because of cases like this. I think I've made the point. There are other cases like this in the data, for example, having to do with the statistics of the low modes.
Right, the cosmic variance.
There are only five particle modes.
Right.
And if they differ, if the observations of them differ from experiment, do we care? Differ between theory and observation? Do we care? And again, this is a case where, because we do not have, we have the freedom to specify initial conditions, but we have no operational counterpart of that freedom in the theory.
Right. So, so again, my temptation is, I mean, I acknowledge in the case of inflation, this is a really important question, like whether you can show that there was a particular field driving the stage of expansion and derive all its properties from observations, given the kind of degeneracy that you're able to you know, swap things between the laws and the initial conditions. But I'm still not sure that this is the kind of counterfactual that probably drive you crazy. But if you imagine a situation in which the early version of inflation ended up working out, in which you had actual strong constraints from particle physics, and that you actually had, you know, an identified field from a particle physics model as the one that was driving inflation, then it seems you'd have a way to resolve that degeneracy, right? Because you would potentially have constraints coming from this other area that would then allow you to resolve these issues. And maybe that's cheating, because then I've now said there's now experimental evidence that bears on this, right? But you could imagine, I'm not sure that it's so much a difference in principle as one, or a difference in kind as one of degree, where you say, imagine that we had a system where you had a much higher degree of testability, where you could actually pin down the effective potential of the inflaton field from all kinds of different observations, right? Then effect you would be able to resolve these degeneracy issues just by using different data sets.
So,
right now, the fact that we're in that situation is an interesting claim, but I'm not so sure that it's due to the uniqueness, right? As opposed to the flexibility of inflation and the difficulty of getting data that allows us to deal with the degeneracy.
So I think it is a difference of views.
You think
what's at stake here is the question of, so the way that I want to put it is, it's not a theory of cosmology that allows the freedom to choose initial conditions of exactly the same kind as the freedom to choose initial conditions for descriptions of laboratory systems, okay, is inadequate. Because however you go step by step, you can make mm-hmm. it a little better. I could make a case in which it's a little worse. At root is the fact that you're using a methodology where there is a methodology drawn from studying subsystems of the universe, mm-hmm. where there's a freedom to put in initial conditions which has an operational meaning. Its operational counterpart is the ability to prepare experiments over and over again on similarly constituted systems. And what seems to be happening is taking this methodology and applying it to, quote, the universe as a whole mm-hmm. leads to empirical inadequacy, however you move it around, because of there's no operational counterpart to the ability to prepare the initial conditions.
Well, I agree that there's no operational counterpart to prepare the initial conditions. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure that I accept the claim that it leads to empirical inadequacy, no matter how. Thanks for your comments. This is very, very helpful. But I should probably shut up. So I don't know anything more useful.
I feel like coming in. I'm not so sure. With one interesting observation, how essential this ability to set up experiments in the laboratory has been historically in classical physics. I can't think of many really great breakthroughs where it was so crucial. I mean, often it was just, I mean, it happened once or twice. Oersted did his great experiment, and it was done once or twice, and then it got through. Where it's really interesting is now in quantum mechanics, where to confirm the probabilities, they really have to do repeated experiments, and they set them up. That is absolutely crucial. That, for me, is a huge change. I think virtually the whole of the scientific revolution was possible without repetition of experiments. It was a minor part of the story.
Yeah.
It was all observations of things where there was little changing of the things
right.
that was done. But then, the other thing is here, which is immensely exciting with cosmology, is the question of whether time exists in one sense and whether there are initial conditions or whether we should be looking for a totally different type of law. And there are hints from the canonical approach to quantum gravity that we have a time-independent type Schrodinger equation governing the mm-hmm. universe, in which case we are in a completely different game.
Right. Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think the... historically, it's so clear that the astronomical evidence was of such higher quality. It was so much more revealing than the experimental evidence in the 17th century on in the 18th century. That I agree that, I mean, so much of the development of dynamics was driven by that as opposed to, you know, experiments with...
And look at all of the breakthrough in geology. It was all done from picking up fossils and carefully recording where they'd come from and mm-hmm. the strata that they were in. It was all deduced from evidence which hasn't changed.
Right.
Essentially, it's the same evidence.
Right.
So, comment on that. I'm going to do in a sec. So, it's maybe not repetition, but you still need, even classical framework, you probably need repeatability. You need to be able to do the experiment again and again to make sure it's okay.
Well, you get lots. We are given a multitude of instantiations, both in time and in space. In geology, we're given them in space. In dynamics of the solar system, we're given them in time. And we don't control them at all, they're just given to us.
Sure. So then, the question then becomes to me anyway, then what do you expect, what do you expect, I think you guys know, but you tell us, so from a cosmological law, what does that mean? Does that mean you want something that will tell us why the universe is the way it is? Is that what you expect? Because that's not what the other laws do. The other laws
right.
talk about how things interact with each other, you know, force laws, symmetry principles. That's really what it's all about. It's about interactions and how these interactions are ruled. here we seem to be talking about a very different kind of thing, which is really a descriptive law in the sense that it's telling us of all, I don't know, statistically, I guess, of all possible universes, why this is particularly this way, as some kind of measure. And that's just a very different problem, essentially, than we have, right?
Yeah, that's part of the reason I asked for examples, and maybe people working in areas where these sorts of laws come up can say something about. Because I think for it to be a distinctively cosmological law in that second sense actually does force it to be something that's quite different than other laws, and is probably not directly derivable from them. Or if it is, it's then unclear why it's not the cosmological law of the first sort, right? So. In that sense, it's. I think you're right that there's a quite big gap between the two types.
And just a quick comment on that: inflationary theory. If you look at it, it is an effort to get rid of some of this ambiguity. Right? Why is the universe flat? You know, in the Robertson Lodger framework, we don't know. Okay, plus one minus one is zero. But then, you know, inflation was invented to get rid of that problem and a bunch of other problems that the simpler cosmology has. So it was an attempt to kind of move towards a broader way of doing cosmology, but still not good enough. And the question is there such a theory that could be good enough for this problem? Or are we ultimately stuck? Which is really, to me, reverting back to the first cause.
Yeah, there's also one, I mean, there's one kind of extreme view which would make it seem that a cosmological law in this sense would sort of eliminate all contingency whatsoever, that you'd have a law that somehow specifies that this is the only possible universe. And that'd be very different than anything we've seen in other physical laws. Yeah, Mark.
I mean, for most field theories, you know, it's going to be very natural set them up locally as initial and boundary value problems with where the cut, where you put the boundaries being fairly small. And then as you move that cut out, you're still using the same inners. Mm-hmm. But you get a huge variety of different situations where you're applying the same laws without doing experiments. It's just by taking different subsections of the universe, then that would support sort of your argument. Now, the trouble with gravitation being so weak, especially when we get into the cosmological concept, we don't have any data about that field, varied applications of the field equations.
Right.
Different boundaries selected differently in the universe. We don't have any data, a rich set of data of that sort that's causing a problem, but you're at least logically, your argument about you don't necessarily need an experiment to get a good test of your field equations in a wide variety of situations by just looking at different parts of the universe.
Right.
Usual truth.
Right. Thank you.
Janann had a question, and then maybe we have time for one or two more.
Yeah. This is sort of a question about the relationship between uniqueness and repeatability, because I would have thought that the worry wasn't that The requirement that people saw lacking in cosmological laws wasn't that we don't have multiple instantiations of the same experiment, or that we don't see the same thing repeated over and over. It's rather the idea of a dimension along which the state of a system can vary, of which we only in principle can see one value. I mean, what are its other values? How do we sort of even develop the idea of a dimension along which the state of a system can vary? In principle, only see one value.
So I think the way most physicists talk about this is that you, for example, take general relativity as what delimits the dimensions of possible cosmological models, and then you might subject that to further constraints, take the ones that are, obey certain causal, nice causal structure and so on, and then that will give you a space of possible universes that gives you the sense of what the, what possible universes might have been actualized. And then what the hell does that mean? Well, I don't know. But so I think one way that people answer this, given that general relativity does describe, you know, global models, is to say, how could you vary? Well, look at the space of possible cosmological models. The problem is that's incredibly broad, right? And the most of the, you know, the Friedman, Robertson, Walker models are of measure zero in there. So it's, if you think that those are all sort of equally possible, then some people think it's a mystery how we could have, you know, a solution that's so highly symmetric. But that's, I think, the way most physicists think about the question of defining what you could mean by, is that what you were asking?
Well, I think so, but then I think sort of the kind of epistemic degeneracy that Lee was pointing to is really pressing. I mean, those judgments are different in kind than the kinds of judgments we make about relations between internal variables, you know, or internal substance judgments.
I'm not sure that they, so, I mean, again, the, if you're still thinking about the subregions as things that satisfy general relativity, I'm not sure exactly what the distinction is that you're drawing. But maybe I just haven't thought about it in those terms. Okay. Sorry.
Hugh, yeah.
I think my question relates to that, and also relates to something that Julian said. From an outsider's point of view, it seems, at least from my outsider's point of view, it sort of seems natural to think that the, well, apart from the problem of uniqueness, there's another kind of explanatory problem that you encounter in cosmology. And that's to do with the fact that, in other places, we have a kind of explanatory model, which is a dynamical model for the initial conditions and the laws when you look for the evolution. But what happens when we get to cosmology, at least when we get to general relativity, is that in some sense, the background that's presupposed by that explanatory model now gets rolled up into the content. You're now looking at space. So the natural thought is that, in some sense, that sort of evolutionary explanatory model is just no longer going to be applicable when the object of study is a whole of space time. Now, I think what the actual practice shows us, and the sort of talk of initial conditions in cosmology here illustrates that, is that the evolutionary model is surprisingly resilient, despite the fact that we now started doing things in terms of space-time. Mm-hmm. But the possibility, which was kind of alluding to in Julian's comment, is that that's not going to last, that's not going to work forever, and that at some point, maybe due to problems we already know about in handling time, all these other reasons to do with time not being fundamental, we just have to give up on the evolutionary model for the questions we're interested in cosmology. And then, it seems to me, we have to fall back on the kinds of things we were just talking about in Jeanette's question. We look at the space of possible global models to define the theory, and then have to think about whether there's something you can regard as an explanatory principle for making selections or doing explanations in terms of some sort of measure on those. So this whole way of looking at things sees the shift from the kind of evolutionary dynamical model of explanation to something else as the crucial thing,
Right. That's very interesting. I don't know that I have much to add, but I think that's an interesting way of phrasing it. I mean, I would say that the discussions I'm citing are certainly putting the emphasis on uniqueness, and so you might be right that there's a deeper issue that's more interesting.
I'm not sure it's deeper, but it's different, I think.
Right. No, I think that's interesting.
Yep. This is just a footnote on things that have already been said. It's a sort of truism in the Bayesian setup that the key to confirmation has rapidly diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. So repetition is not that big of a deal, but you get a huge punch out of variety. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you put a new theory on the table that unifies things that appear to be independent, then you get that huge push and confirmation out of that. Mm-hmm. And that really agrees with the comment about classical physics, certainly in Principia, because all Newton could do is get those observations from Flamsteed, right, and then he adds to that a few things with Pendula from Boyle's law, and you get the whole edifice, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, the unification of the celestial and the terrestrial, getting the pendulum to be
periodic motions in heavens, which were supposed to be completely different mechanisms, even as Kepler saw it. You know, you feel like there's just got to be something to it. But then I guess, why can't, you know, that unification stuff could happen for a non-repeatable event just as well as for a repeatable one?
Right.
So, I mean, it really makes you wonder why the repeatability matters so much, except to weed out spurious effects.
Right, thanks. I mean, I agree with that.
I don't know if I can just come in.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. One last thing is, I do think that this repeatability, but I would call it horizontal repeatability. I think, again, the example of geology. Mm-hmm. You work out, you get some facts in one part of the world.
Right, right.
And that tells you I should find similar or closely related mm-hmm. phenomena in China.
Right.
And you go there and you find them.
Right.
That's very important.
Right.
Well, that touches on Kevin's comment, but it's actually a huge landmine working here. In statistics, scientific method, it's called cross-validation. It's the idea that if I'm trying to decide between two theories, and I've got a corpus of data I need to explain, I take both of my theories, fit them to only part of the data, out seeing what's been held out, and then the one which best explains what's held out is the one I go with. Mm-hmm. It's the scientific method codified algorithmically. It is standard operating procedure in statistics for how you do things like set regularization parameters, set hyperparameters in the context of Bayesian analysis, what's called ML2, and so on. It is completely unjustified formally. So this is actually touching on another issue, which is the way the horizontal, which is exactly what Julian was addressing. Intuitively, we all accept that completely. In a lot of my work on machine learning, I use cross-validation. The most recent winners of the Netflix competition use some areas of some network on cross-validation. Mm-hmm. It has currently zero theoretical motivation. There's a lot of things that people have tried to do in terms of asymptotics, but that actual aspect of the scientific method, horizontal as opposed to repeatability, it makes intuitive sense. But we haven't actually formally shown that that should give us anything more than a 1 plus a field.
Are there no Go theorems, or is it just a failure of Go theorems?
There's very little that's been actually established theoretically at all.
Okay.
There are some asymptotic results that are very limited and frankly don't even really address cross-validation as used. Just simple things like if I'm doing curve fitting, I have a regularization parameter. So I'm doing a spline fit, and I just want to figure out how much do I penalize integrated curvature of my fit. Standard way to do it is what I said, if you have some data that you're trying to fit the curve to, do a spline fit to that with various values of your parameter and see which one best fits the held out data. It's got asymptotic justification, but you know, as the cliche goes, in the middle, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. Essentially nothing is known about why it is so compelling and does work so well in the finite regime.
I think one more about the
very I just have a question for Julian. What is the significance of the fourth theory of the distinction between repeatability and variety? Isn't it the same issue of finding the one in the many?
Finding the unity in the many,
yes,
I would say. Yes, I mean, I think, or the similarity in the many, I mean, variety is certainly, for me, the meta-law of doing science is there must be something variegated. Then you can make distinctions. And then if you can find that there are patterns that are either similar or else you can have a theory which explains why they're slightly different and things like that, then you're away. And it seems to me the whole of modern science is just confirmation of one fantastic story, which the universe began in some very special state, and this since then evolved in accordance with a curious mixture of classical and quantum mechanics, which we don't grasp and understand, but somehow we managed to delicately do it. And all around us we find evidence that confirms this one huge story. It's up in the sky, it's in our DNA, it's in everywhere we look, in geology, everywhere we look we find confirmation of this one day. This is for me what the scientific revolution is about. It's just an incredible story. But as Roger Penrose is always emphasizing, it relies so heavily on that incredibly special initial condition, despite what inflation says. Alan Booth confirmed to me a lot of what he originally hoped to do with inflation, he didn't do. He got some other great big triumphs, but in the source, he confirmed that. That, I think, is the really exciting thing. Can we explain why this universe seems to start? It's so very special. That's been alluded to already by everyone, I think, hasn't it?
Well, I think that's excellent talk and discussion, and let's take 20 minutes and then come back for a very long week.